You are listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network. One of Us is a podcast and video network funded all but entirely by donations and subscriptions. We do accept pitches for audio-based or banner ads, but on a case-by-case basis. If you're interested in that, contact us at oneofusnet@gmail.com. With the amount of audio and video content we generate, it is expensive and extremely time-consuming to keep things running. Please go to the webpage oneofus.net and sign up for a subscription at $2, $5, $10, or $25 and get a ton of bonus content. One of Us needs and appreciates all your support. You know, I am a fan of the Hollywood movie about Hollywood movie makers. I know some people are just automatically like, nope, don't want anything to do with that. Don't want to watch The Player or any of those things about like, look how great we are, we people who make movies. Or alternately, look how terrible but also great we are, we people who make movies. And I kind of feel like this new movie is that one of the latter, where it's kind of both. Taking a look at one of the really unsung greats of Hollywood, who produced such films as Cleopatra Schwartz and Catholic High School Girls in Trouble, as well as, of course, A Fistful of Yen. This movie about the great Samuel L. Bronkowitz is something that has been
Hold on, I'm checking my notes here, Chris.
What? Did I watch? We're doing the review for Bronk, right?
No. Same number of syllables.
Wrong meeting.
Yeah.
Sorry, no, the Samuel L. Bronkowitz movie is another one. Sorry, that's a Kentucky Fried Movie joke. Only person here who even plausibly might have gotten that joke is Marco, and even he is embarrassed.
I have made
at me
three
for
Kentucky Fried movie jokes this evening based alone on some new Lifetime movie that apparently they're getting
Mario Lopez
to play Colonel Sanders in some like romance thing. I don't
know. Swell looking fella.
It doesn't matter because I'm never going to see it, so it may as well not exist.
Yeah, I love people like, I can't wait to see this thing. I'm like, this advertising for Kentucky Fried Chicken? Okay, if you say so. Anyway, we're not here to review that either. We're here to review the latest David Fincher film, which by default makes it kind of a shoo-in for award season consideration, of course, that is about screenwriter Herman J. Mankiewicz, as played about 20 or so years older than he should be by Gary Oldman. But you know what? Kind of the idea is this guy is such a broken-down drunk in many ways that it's kind of a joke. He looks much older than he actually is.
Joe Mankiewicz had an 82-year-old liver. Yeah, by the time he was done with it.
I think we can identify with that. But joining me on this review today is, of course, Marco.
Hello, everybody.
Alexander.
Howdy.
And Jordan. She'll be with us in just a moment.
Why, hello there.
What's the good word from the Mid-Atlantic?
I got a big time story coming right in. Come on in. Get me a Bromo Seltzer. It's going to be a long night.
Get some newsies in here. I need some coffee, some donuts, and some hot news stories.
Get me some Chesterfield Kings and a bottle of scotch.
Why, I am certainly not a dame dressed up as a bride, hopefully to get their dream job. Absolutely not. That would be ridiculous.
Boy, it's like the weird 80s film that never happened. Just one of the Mid-Atlantic guys. Anyway, so Mank was indeed a undersung legend, I believe, to some at least. In fact, even this film that is written by David's dear departed father, Jack Fincher, who was a professional screenwriter. He died in 2003, so this script's got him been sitting around for a while. But one of the main criticisms this film's been getting so far is that it's not entirely based on what is generally regarded to be the truth about this guy and which this is centered around, the scripting of Citizen Kane and his relationship with Orson Welles and William Randolph Hearst, because this was based on an essay that Pauline Kael wrote that was criticizing Welles for not including Mankiewicz and giving him enough credit. In fact, that insinuated that Welles had absolutely nothing to do with the writing with this, which is generally considered to be wildly untrue.
Yeah, that was Raising Cain, her book-length article. And then, of course, Peter Bogdanovich responds back going, actually, no. And he writes his own book, Raising Cain, disputing what Pauline Kael said. I think probably the history is a little bit more nuanced than either side would be willing to admit. Joe Mankiewicz was kind of considered a washed-up screenwriter at this point in his career. He had been famous mostly for basically being a well-regarded script doctor.
Joe was his brother, who was played by someone else.
That is correct. And he is a character in the movie, not Joe Mankiewicz. I tend to get them mixed up. But the Mank that we're dealing with, he was a well-known Hollywood script doctor and was kind of considered as washed up. And then, of course, Wunderkind Orson Welles comes into town and goes, oh, I can work with whoever I want. He picks Mankiewicz, who pitches him this story based somewhat loosely on the life of William Randolph Hearst, the newspaper magnate and very powerful political figure. That's kind of where the movie really lives, is like the argument over who did what. And there is no doubt that both Jack Fincher, not surprisingly a magazine writer himself, who felt at times that he had become a hack, he's definitely in the Mankiewicz camp.
I don't even think this is entirely about that either. That is a sideline. The film's definitely the center of it is Gary Oldman's Mankiewicz, no question. But the film is kind of more about, God, I can't remember, I think Greg Bear wrote this book about where you could time travel, but only in the sense that you could watch the past at points. Oh, yeah. And this is like him wanting to do that. Yeah. Like, he just wants to show this, like, no explanation. This is what was going on around this guy. And at points, that's a little intimidating if you're not really familiar with this period. I mean, I looked at the list on Wikipedia of like people it says are represented in here. I'm like, where? Yeah. I don't remember seeing them.
Well, you all know Joe von Sternberg. It was like, of course it's Josef von Sternberg, but you know what? Half the audience doesn't know that. And I kind of love that, but also understand why that will be a challenge to some people.
I would only know half of these names because I studied them in my cinema history classes. It is wild. Yeah, I even read that even some of the earlier drafts were staunchly very anti-Orson Welles. But this movie does answer a question I've been wondering for a long time. How do we make a David Fincher movie even more dour? We take out all the color and that'll do it. It'll be amazing. While Mank does nicely blend between fact and fiction, I do gotta say, this is one of my favorite movies of the year. It is absolutely fantastic. Gary Oldman is just wonderful, and this is an absolute stat cast. And it's honestly one of my favorite movies in a while that's behind the curtain, as it were, as to Hollywood. I think it's the best sort of movie about Hollywood since I think Tropic Thunder.
Okay, fair enough.
But John Houseman, the producer, never gets blown up by a landmine. I just want to make that clear.
That would have been good.
And that was one of my few problems with this movie. No one steps on a landmine.
In terms of the look of it, he brought in Eric Messerschmidt, who he worked with on Gone Girl and Mindhunter for it. And he creates a very deep focus, very detailed image throughout this thing with all these scenes of old Hollywood, sometimes out in the desert, sometimes in the middle of things, sometimes inside of San Simeon, Hearst's castle.
Or Xanadu, as it was known in Kane.
I like the look of it a lot. I found it somewhat impenetrable, though, and I will tell you exactly why. First, I do love Gary Oldman's portrayal. He is this raucous wit that everybody both loves and is a little afraid of because he's such a drunk and he's such an inveterate gambler. He has no self-control, and no one denies that he has some real genius, but good luck getting it out of him. People are kind of shocked that Welles, who is this new 25-year-old Wunderkind, even wants to work with this guy at all.
He already worked with him in the Mercury Theater, so it was a case of like, and if you know the Citizen Kane story, he brought most of the Mercury Theater crew with him to Hollywood.
Well, I mean, Hollywood were the ones, though, who were like, what are you doing? That guy's washed up. But he still had a lot of friends, even in this film. It shows how he became friends himself with Charles Foster Kane, not Charles Foster, William Randolph Hearst,
essentially,
and his live-in lover, Marion Davies, who I thought was his wife, but they never got married. Hearst's previous wife refused to divorce him. So back then, that was not something you could, like, insist would happen. If there's a female co-star in here at all, it's Amanda Seyfried playing Marion Davies. But I think one of my problems here, and my wife is the one who pointed this out to me, there's not really. She and Lily Collins, who plays a secretary, they're both characters who pop up just long enough every once in a while to go either, oh, Mank, you're wonderful, or oh, Mank, you're so troubled, or oh, Mank, you asshole. And they don't really have much of a plot arc of their own. No. They're not really interesting characters, and they're not given any real voice to do anything other than reflect off of Mank. So if we're talking about a film that is balanced in its portrayal of female characters, this is most certainly not that film.
No, agreed. It's totally not. Everybody is sort of subservient to the genius of Mank, and all of the women are presented as his caretakers, nurses. It's a running gag. It's barely a plot line where his own wife, who's sort of jokingly referred to as poor Sarah, Mank is constantly asking her, why is it you're still with me? How do you still put up with me? And even she doesn't seem to have a good answer for it. And it's one of the flaws of the film in that I don't think the film ever really gives us a good reason why she would be this long-suffering wife, because he's clearly a difficult person to live with.
It's in love with the tragic genius, this movie, certainly, as was the essay, I feel like, that this is based on. The idea, this man who never really got his due and suffered because no one took him seriously enough or gave him what he deserved for his genius. And, you know, I mean, it would have been more interesting to see a slightly more well-rounded picture, and especially a film that seems so determined in showing you a portrait more of the times. When people talk, there is no giving to maybe people don't know exactly what was happening in this particular date politically around the world. It's just happening. And there's a lot of politics in this that faintly resonates of our world today. You know, there's a depression going on. There's a big election going on. And it's weird to see Hollywood being like super anti-socialist. You're like, well, that's something certainly changed there.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me that one of the major sticking points of the film is that it takes this idea that you assume Hollywood is this big liberal bastion, and yet at the time you see no less than Louis B. Mayer is like the head of the California GOP committee to get their guy elected, and they're all up against Upton Sinclair. This is the interesting part of the story that I did not expect. Apparently, Jack Fincher's original draft was much more closer to the Cale concept of like man of genius overlooked by, you know, another man of genius. When his son said, look, I'm not buying this script, go back and rewrite it, because even then David Fincher was a dick, going, Dad, sorry, but your script needs work. And so he went back, and in like so many authors, they did some research and they went down that rabbit hole, and he really latched onto this idea of socialist Upton Sinclair running for the 1934 election for governor, and you see how that leads in a weird way to the rise of fake news. Eerily prescient.
Yeah, I felt this movie worked best when it focused on the political climate of the late 1930s, early 40s, where there were a number of socialists who were writing books about issues with American culture, and then that created this era of propaganda and nationalism that is slowly become today.
That's definitely reflected here.
Yeah, you have a guy who's written over 100 novels running to be governor, and now we have a president who can't even read a book.
It's not that he can't, he won't.
I keep feeling like Jordan is in that beginning of the third act of the 80s movie we were talking about, where she shows up to work but forgets to take off her fingernail polish, and there's that, and she's like walking around like this, and
there are many things I'm willing to do for a bit, but I'm not going to give up being fucking fabulous.
That's fair. I don't think you could if you wanted to.
I'm spiffy.
He's basically New Jack Ducky. That's what she is.
New Jack Ducky.
Okay.
New Jack
Ducky. Okay, now I'm taking this shit off.
Oh, yeah. He's like, I invoke the name of John Cryer and the bow tie comes
off. No, not John Cryer. He's redeemed himself by playing Lex Luthor. It's Ducky that you fucking brought up.
Fuck Ducky.
Alex is absolutely right on about the political aspect of this movie, and I think is the engine that drives it. If you hear Citizen Kane, Orson Welles, Mankiewicz, you might think you know what you're getting into. You never see Citizen Kane being filmed. It involves the drafting of the original screenplay, but really this is about the character of Mankiewicz as a washed-up writer who's kind of spent most of his career in a solid fucking drunk, and has kind of come to realize that he's not only a hack who's no longer at the top of his game or relevant, but that he's also compromised all of his ideals along the way until he has an opportunity in his mind to set things right. What I think is genius about this movie is that it's actually a guy who is trying to set things right and stand up for what he believes in for seemingly the first time in a long time, but it's also driven by a very petty sort of jealousy. And that makes him a complex, layered character. He's not a saint. He's got his reasons, but he also has some petty axes to grind as well.
And we see that there is inside of him this man who is generous to a fault. There's a conversation between him and a German housekeeper that he's worked with for a long time where she's like, he got me and literally every person in my village out of Nazi Germany. He personally paid for them to come over here, and he had absolutely no reason to do that. So don't you dare say a word against him. If the man wants to get drunk every day, he's a grown-up, he can do what he wants. And you're like, you know, I mean, if you really loved him, you'd probably, but no, I'm not going to go there.
Yeah.
Which is also one of the big sticking points of the movie, because historically, Mankiewicz was probably not this big of a socialist as the film portrays him. This is clearly the most politically slanted film that David Fincher has ever directed, and it's really quite surprising.
We need a hero in this movie, and since it's not Bill Nye, it's up in Sinclair that's on top of the marquee, we gotta have somebody. Although I did like that cameo, actually.
It's weird that this character, who is pretty much the third man of this film, Upton Sinclair, first I thought that was going to be who Wells was, who has this very brief appearance in the beginning, and then it's not till towards the end that we see him again, but you do see enough of him that I wouldn't say that he's not as important to the film, but Sinclair is the boogeyman that everybody is afraid of.
There's like one 2-3 minute scene where Mank is outside a theater, and we see Sinclair. I did a double take because I've watched this movie twice. And on the first view, and I was like, is that fucking Bill Nye? That's Bill Nye's science guy, which is
appropriate.
Yeah, that's inspired casting.
And he's filmed almost entirely from the back.
Oh, yeah. What I do love about this movie is that it is structured much like Citizen Kane. That shouldn't be so much a shock, but honestly, it really works. And I feel like if no one's ever really seen Citizen Kane, and they're just going to watch Mank, they're going to get thrown through a whirlwind of how the narrative just goes all over the place. As amazingly as it worked in Citizen Kane, it honestly actually still works here.
It's very much Hamlet putting on the play to catch the king off guard, and it works. But the other thing, like what Jordan was saying, for some people this may throw them for a loop. It's worth pointing out that Citizen Kane, which also has an intricate flashback within flashback structure, never tells you when and where you are, yet you intuitively follow it. Mank adds an extra meta layer by actually showing titles. You see
interior.
Yeah, you see the scriptwriter headings, the slug lines telling you exactly when and where you are and indicating that it's a flashback. And I almost wonder if that's Fincher and his people sitting in the editing room going, people today can't follow a movie like this. We got to tell them where we are.
If Mank had spent the entire one time period in bed, which he starts in with a broken leg, then sure, we wouldn't need that because it's obvious which time period you're in. But he doesn't. After a certain point, he just looks exactly like he does the other way. And it would be very confusing without those. But it does get into the idea of like, this was an incredibly complicated script for this time. People were worried there was no real way to film or make this movie, that it would be too smart for most audiences or almost any audiences. If this movie is about the making of Citizen Kane, it's more about it in the sense that as we watch all these elements in Mank's life and the things that were happening to him and the things that were happening to Hollywood, in some way, not really always overtly, but in some way you can see how this affected his vision for what ended up becoming the movie Citizen Kane that he wrote. More so than, oh, these are things that went wrong during the process of creating it. He said that he only meets with Wells like twice in the movie.
Having Sinclair as someone to contrast Mank, someone who is open and publicly as a figure, preaching his truths about socialism and then creating propaganda pieces. And Mank is trying to make a movie where he wants to sell all of these ideas that he has, but he doesn't want to make propaganda, which is ultimately what, I mean, Citizen Kane was about.
Him accidentally leading the studio to create their most aggressive and most artifice-driven propaganda ever and being horrified by his own mistake.
That is the big argument that the film is making, and that's probably the moment where it most digresses from the real history. Those propaganda films existed. Did Mankiewicz suggest them? I don't know. don't know. By all accounts, the man was fairly conservative himself. Not a fascist, but still fairly conservative. But here's the thing that's interesting about it. If Citizen Kane is basically a mystery, where everybody spends the whole movie trying to figure out the secret of Rosebud, Kane's final word upon his deathbed, and then you get the answer. The characters don't. We, the audience, do in one of the most famous final shots of the movie, of any movie. And I went back on the second watch because I was curious about this, because there is also a mystery at the heart of Mank. And it is, what is it that makes Mankiewicz burn his bridges with Hearst and Davies and write this scathing movie that is very loosely but obviously based on them? And we don't get the answer at the end. We get it at exactly the halfway point. I checked. In a movie that's 2 hours and 12 minutes, at an hour and 6 minutes, in a scene with Mank and Irving Thalberg, you see the moment where he accidentally, according to this movie, creates fake news. And that anger, that sense of betrayal, that sense of, oh my God, what have I done? Not to mention the fact that he has, you know, become persona non grata at the Hearst house, sets him off on this mission to just write this story, even when everybody's trying to tell him, dude, do not write this. You are going to get so much shit. You'll never work in this town again. And of course, Orson Welles, who has had him agree, look, this is just a work for hire. You're never going to have your name on it. You know, you're not going to catch any of the flack. I will. And also, I get to look like the great genius of cinema, who's the writer, director, actor, star. But at some point during the process, he goes, you know what? This is the best thing I've ever written. It's the first time I've written something I care about, and he demands credit. And that's where the break between he and Welles occurs. It's a really interesting way to take the Kane structure and kind of fracture it, bend it upon itself, and instead of putting the answer at the end, putting it in the middle.
Marco, what are your final thoughts?
As it should be obvious by now, I could talk at length about this movie. I'm fascinated by it. I'm very reluctant to use the word inaccessible because I think that always sounds disrespectful to our audience, kind of gatekeepery. It's like, oh, I get this, but you couldn't. I mean, this is the kind of movie where somebody offhandedly says, oh yeah, Upton Sinclair, he took the studio's money, ran off to Mexico to make some Russian propaganda film, and you're going, oh, he's talking about Sergei Eisenstein's Que Viva Mexico. That's amazing. Or like, oh, here's Ben Hecht. I'm like, of course there's Ben Hecht and George Kaufman.
Marco's final thoughts are inaccessible.
Exactly. But
Marco, were you one of my teachers?
I've never taught you anything. Or maybe you've never learned anything, in which case that's not on me. It is that kind of movie where if you're a total movie nerd, this has as many references and Easter eggs as a Marvel or Lucasfilm movie does. But it's aimed at dudes who love this era of Hollywood filmmaking, which is why it may feel inaccessible to some people. But what a lot of folks remember when they get past the fact that Citizen Kane is like a homework movie, when you get that shit out of your mind, it's fun. It operates on its own rhythm. It moves quickly. The dialogue is punchy. The characters are fun and memorable. I think this movie is totally accessible. And if anything, the style of its shooting just proves how based in classic Hollywood principles David Fincher's style is really rooted. I think this is a movie anyone can enjoy, even if they don't particularly know the era or the history, but certainly that will help, especially if you've seen Citizen Kane a couple of times. I have to give this 9 out of 10 prop handkerchiefs full of crocodile tears dropped from a moving cab. If you watch this movie and you're not into it, a few more years from now, you might. Come back to this. I think you're going to dig it.
I love the scene in here, just in reference to a review, where Mank has just had a fight with Meyer and he leans back in the cab and goes, Grogu! And he's so excited when Baby Yoda recognizes him. Yeah.
That's right. Because it's only good because somebody recognized it. That's right. It's all fan service, Chris.
Alex?
I think you watched The Mankalorian. So, I don't know.
Ooh.
This movie is a dense, rich love note to early Hollywood in its quote-unquote golden age with this glowing fucking black and white. They put little cigarette burns in the corner. It's great. I love it. It's an era that needs to be, I don't know, more scrutinized than it is. But I'm going to give this 9 out of 10 organ grinders monkeys.
Jordan?
You did bring that up. I wanted to mention how just fucking terrifying Charles Dance is as William Randolph Hearst, especially giving that parable. Yeah, this movie's fantastic. It speaks to me as a Hollywood cinephile and someone who has studied Citizen Kane. Actually thinking of rewatching it after we get done with this, because it has been a while, and having watched The Mank twice is incredible. Could do its female characters a hell of a lot better, let's be honest. But it is full of amazing performances and incredible story that still rings true today. Gary Oldman might just snag up another Oscar for playing a historic drunk. That seems to be his thing. I think this is one of David Fincher's best. So I will give it 9 out of 10 copies of The Third Man, which you should also watch, from Orson Welles. It is fan-goddamn-tastic.
You know, I'm going to be the odd man out here, and I thought this was a really interesting misfire. I was not in love with this, in fact. I thought this was really uneven. I thought it wasn't entirely sure what it wanted to be. I was deeply annoyed by, despite the fact it was rewritten from David Fincher's dad's original script, it stuck to that premise that has been since pretty much thoroughly debunked, and I find that kind of, I don't know, kind of gross to intentionally just go with this misunderstanding of history and sell it as true. I really did, as it went along, start to get annoyed. At first, it didn't bother me that these side characters, these female characters, didn't have as much to do because it's about Mank, but then it's kind of the way they end up using them made it feel even lesser in that sense. When I call it, Marco, when I refer to this as impenetrable, I'm not saying it might be impenetrable to you. I'm saying it was impenetrable to me, and I have watched every bonus feature on my Citizen Kane giant brick of a box set that I have, okay? I know a lot about this period, and even I was like, I have no idea what the fuck they're talking about. And even if I did, I'd be like, was this necessary to keep this conversation in the film? It feels overlong and bloated. It's beautifully shot. It's largely really well acted. There's some people I like better than others in here. I thought Arliss Howard kind of overplays it a bit as Louis Mayer. I don't know. I would have liked to have seen a lot more of Ferdinand Kingsley as Irving Thalberg, who is a truly fascinating individual. And I would watch a biopic about him alone. What really fascinating golden boy of Hollywood production who died unexpectedly, deeply young, but not from personal abuse the way Mank did.
He had a congenitive heart failure. Died at 38 after producing like 300, 400 movies.
It's nice to see that there's a film paying credit to this guy who is a sort of a lovable wit, if you will, around town, who had a few credits that were well worth paying attention to, including, obviously, what was up until recently considered by many to be the greatest film ever made. Apparently, recently, Sight and Sound, for the first time in their history, took it off their number one spot and replaced it with Vertigo. I know. I was like, what?
No, it's valid. But of course, Vertigo wouldn't exist without Citizen Kane.
No, and that was, I read this article that was linked by one of our members that was suggesting that, like, okay, so, because Citizen Kane, they were saying, is not even Orson Welles' best movie, so how can it be the best movie of all times? Because it was always considered in the context of how much happened because of Citizen Kane, and I think there have been many discussions since then of, like, yes, but...
I read that article by Richard Brody, and I wanted to slap him, because you don't get to say, it's not even Welles' best movie, without actually saying what the best movie was.
You know,
he just mentions that, he just drops that, like, what was it, Chimes at Midnight? It was like Touch of Evil,
F for Fake,
you know. Come on, man, give me, don't leave me hanging here.
Well, I won't leave you hanging, and I will get to my final review, which is to say, while I did really admire a lot about this, I mean, this felt like an example to me of a director who has enough power and control that everyone's kind of afraid to tell them what they should or shouldn't do, and instead you end up with an overbloated film filled with lots of genius, but desperately in need of an edit to cut it a little short. This is basically the non-action equivalent of another movie this year that I think the same way about, Tenet. So I'm going to give this 7 out of 10 Baby Yodas in the backseat.
But even despite all of the purposeful degrading of the sound and audio to make this sound like a 1940s picture, it's still at least a lot more audible and understandable than Tenet.
Who'd like to hear about the hottest new thing? Homosexual women fighting werewolves.
What? Bring that to the presses!
I did it, Ma!
Sounds like a B picture.
Jordan, you've got a promotion coming for you. I see big things ahead of you. It's a good thing you're not a woman.
I know, right? Oh, yeah.